Welcome back to the Life on Target podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Spearing, bringing you my interview today with Arthur Kwan Lee. Now, y'all, I'm going to be a little bit honest and transparent here. When I first met Arthur at County Before Country, he's a little bit different than I am. He's got a flat cap on. He's got some earrings. He's got a little bit. He walks with a little bit of a swagger. And being a red-blooded American male, you're always kind of looking around the room, sizing people up, looking at their appearance, looking at their aesthetic, and making snap judgments about them. And so I was kind of a little bit taken aback as he entered the room. I knew he was an artist. I knew he was speaking. And I reserved waited rendering the final verdict on this guy until I heard him speak. But obviously he was different than I was. He's an artist. He's a painter. He harmonizes expressive color palettes with the world of mythology and religious icons. And that's not typically viewed as painting is not typically viewed as masculine. Shame on us. That's all I got to say. Shame on you if you're thinking about, oh, this painter, who's this guy? I don't know about that. You know what else he did at the end of County Before Country? He got his gi on. He's a judo brown belt. He and John Moody, who you guys just heard from last week's oldest son, and John Moody, they went at it. They locked grasp. They did the judo thing, the sport, the discipline, and, you know, took their convictions, took their discipline to a martial virtue as well. So combined with the speech that he gave and the studying of the martial virtues and their incredible presentation on the arts and how it points us to truth, I asked him if he would come on the podcast. And you guys, so just let's get to the interview. And also, please stick around for the outro where I'm going to give information about a new project that he just released and explain it to you a little bit more. Without further ado, my interview with Arthur Kwan Lee. So yeah, coming right off of County Before Country, I had a great time. Got to watch you spar with John Moody and his son, which for me, I think that was the clinch factor, pun intended, for that conference. You got guys discussing men. Discussing farming, discussing business, discussing art. And then official conclusion of the conference, and you guys get the gis on. And right there on the mat, you know, not the mats like padded mats, but right there on the workout.
On the floor.
Like rubber floor, started doing some judo sparring. And is that the style that you're training? I know that there's a bunch of
I'm a judoka. Discipline.
Okay. And then when did you start that?
So, I mean, I've been doing martial arts pretty much my whole life. I did taekwondo for the most part, and I did a little bit of boxing. And then I started judo 4.5 years ago. Took kind of a long break, but I'm going to be going back on a mat, like seriously. At a competitive club this coming Wednesday. But, you know, Nathan, you know, what I care about is culture. You mm-hmm. know, so when you talk about all these men discussing all of these important subjects and themes, and when I say culture, I mean the actual bones of getting into it, you know? Mm-hmm. So judo right there, when we're sparring and we're grabbing gis and we're putting it on our body and pushing and pulling, that's culture right there. So all this discussion is important, but I think what attracts me to judo is analogous to what attracts me to painting. It's you're actually producing with your hands, or you're it's actually in your the say of what you're producing is actually up to you know. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, that's kind of like that's my heart's contentment.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The I don't know if you're familiar with Shop Classes, Soulcraft, the book. And he talks just about how doing things tangible with your hands is a way to speak, you know, without words, essentially. And there's, you know, this is me kind of distilling his comments down to just, there's gravitas in that. You look at this, the house stands, you know, the car runs, the, you know, you're awarded the point because you got the takedown. Like it's speaking louder than just what words. And the author talks about, you know, talking about it is what professors and things like that do, but the man just points, you know, look, this is, you know, and I guess that.
Yeah. My paintings have spoken volume beyond any of my conferences or lectures at that, mm-hmm. you know, cause I mean, I get way more feedback from people saying how the art has moved them and convinced them of traditional roles, you know, preserving the West and the reverence towards aesthetic imagery when it comes to attempting to point towards God than even my conferences or my lectures at that. So that's, you know, you're preaching to the choir at that. So,
So give us if we could just play the audio from your speech, I think that our listeners would get a ton out of that, but just your intro, I mean, you started with a photo of your family, I think, and so that just all of that rings a bell, and just look in how you talked about your father and the sage counsel that he gave you in some of the hottest moments and all that would be just awesome. Just tell us, inform the listeners.
Sure. Let me give long story short here. So I come from a family of a traditional Christian family, but we're very odd because we're all artists. Mm-hmm. It's very unique in that regard because, you know, besides my father, who appreciates art, everyone else is delving into something aesthetic, you know? So I'm a painter, I'm a visual artist. My sword is the brush. My mother, she piano, cello, and composer. My sister, she plays the violin adamantly with some classical ballet background. My brother was into the theater and acting and all this. So it's very odd in that way. Cause you know, we kind of had this weird situation where we're always into the classics and reading about aesthetic and philosophy and religion. Cause my father's also a senior pastor and, you know, he has his doctorate in divinity. So it's very right brain oriented family. So we're always spending time together and it's usually something surrounding the arts amongst the fellowship as well. So it's a beautiful thing. So my attraction to the arts just came from the fact that I come from this sort of milieu, you know? So I have all these creative people around me. So I was like, you know, not all of us became artists, all the kids, like, you know, but for me, I never liked school and especially the fact that I was in a government school. So, you know, that's basically a place to castrate masculine temperament itself. So I was just kind of fed up with it. And art was something so wholesome for me. And I just, spoke to something that I can develop and grow and channel my temperaments and philosophy and growing skills, ideology, and philosophy and aggression too. So it's something I can channel it into. And because of that focus, I ended up going to this art school. And art school is obviously a place for radical leftism today. And but with that, I learned a very important skill to succeed in the secular world if you are a man of God, which is social camouflage. So in conjunction to my skill set being strong and coming from this family of Christian artists and Christianity also producing the greatest aesthetic feats throughout history, it allowed me to use that same pool to create masterclass works. So as I was getting this attention, I was also kind of being this beta male hypocrite because what is in my heart and what made me an artist, I wasn't speaking up. So the personal and the public were kind of at odds. But again, like I knew that I was an outlier because I was surrounded by atheist and radical liberal personalities in art school. And if these are the gatekeepers for who you get introduced to as the next step, you know, I'm going to tread very carefully, right? Mm. And eventually I was invited to this residency called Eileen Escominski Family Foundation, very competitive, internationally known residency. And, you know, I can't say no to an opportunity like that. So I was one of the youngest members ever to be invited because these artists are all a lot older. They've kind of been around the block. You get invited to this program when you're kind of a veteran in the art game. And I'm like, I'm not there. I was pretty young at that stage. But so it was such an honor I went in because of my skill set. And because I was in there, I started to get a lot of attention from certain art dealers, specifically in the Lower East Side of New York and Soho. And I got a lot of solo exhibitions. Solo exhibitions mean the art critics contact you. White Hot Magazine, hottest art magazine in New York, Art Verge, they start to contact me. Of course, if they're going to look at the art and how the art is speaking to you, because beauty is something that will point things out, brother, they're going to also end up asking about who is the man creating this art. And as they delved into that, they basically realized that I was everything that they hated. I was a Trump-supporting, conservative, right-leaning Christian. And also, I'm not supposed to have any of those perspectives as an Asian man, apparently. I didn't know that. So all these things are just dicing very dangerously. And also, you know, I don't look like the typical conservative, even in a blue state. You know, I have these earrings and it's like I enjoy, you know, I shave my head and, you know, I don't have a beard like you or any of that. Like I almost look like them, but I don't live like them, you know? So it got to this extent, you know, where, you know, long story short, I was caught at a bar hanging out with people that they despise even further, you know, Gavin McGinnis and Alexander Cortez, certain heads like that. And then, you know, push comes to shove, they're like, what is your, you know, did you vote for Donald Trump that, you know, that year? And I'm like, yes, I did. And I got blacklisted. And when you get blacklisted in the art industry, it's not like you get a letter or anything like that. You know, they don't tell you, hey, we don't want to work with you anymore. No, they just stop contacting you altogether. They all talk to each other. So I had six pretty hot art galleries and they all wanted nothing to do with me. So, you know, this happened 2 years ago. So it's pretty fresh, but I'm still looking back in retrospect. When it occurred, Nathan, it was very disconcerting. It really was. But now I'm looking back, realizing God has given me an opportunity to be independent and to become the artist for the Christian community. And that's what I sort of realized, because I became an artist because of my Christian family. So I kind of realized, I kind of came full circle. It's like a prodigal son based on the climate kind of occurred. So now I'm at this place where I'm trying to utilize the talent that's been bestowed upon me to serve and to spread masculinity in a positive light, because I think that's also an important sore when it comes to the next step in the culture fight for Christians to yield their masculinity shamelessly, you know, which is why I have this portrait of me, of Christ Panther Creator, here with you, with a sword, not just the Bible. Let me show him. You wouldn't want to run into this Christ here.
We had a guy recently come into our circles at our church, and he's like, I just read Luke, and why did nobody tell me that Jesus was a badass, you know?
Right.
And he was discovering he didn't grow up churched. And that's some of that is my experience as well. Always a Christian, but home church, but he didn't grow up getting fed the same things that the establishment church, likes to hang out in. And so he was just going through the word himself and reading about him making a whip and driving those profiteering off the church from the temple, you know, and
that's the best way to do it. Yeah. This, you know, I got to tell you, you look at the depictions of Christ historically, and the further back you go, the more shamelessly masculine he is depicted. And of course, you can say the argument, well, yeah, it's because back then, you know, things were a lot harder. So, you know, hard times make strong men. And so that's just the way the aesthetics are depicted. I'm like, yeah, but you can also see that all the modern depictions of Christ, literally the most recent depictions of Christ are, he looks, you know, that whole hippie image where, you know, he looks like, he looks like a weak man in many ways. And I believe that is the fault of the church. And I think that churches have to preach more loving intolerance. I think I believe that is the most important thing for Christians. And I'm speaking for myself, by the way, I believe, and also my father's congregation at that. I believe the most important thing churches have to do is start standing up with their intolerance, because the problem of these blue state churches that I've always been surrounded with, because I'm here, you look, like again, like, you know, like we discussed, I just came from beautiful Ohio, salt of the earth people, man, it was awesome. And I come back here to the DC swamp with judgmental people in suits looking at me, and I realized right there, yep, this is what's going on. And all the churches here have BLM and rainbow flags that are higher than the actual placement of the cross. And I don't think that is a mistake. I think that is intentional. And because any righteous pastor who actually is following the Bible would say, you know, would stand up again, stand up against the vaccine mandates, abortion, shamelessly, homosexuality, all this. And, you know, the saying that if you tolerate everything, you don't believe in anything. Well, I think Christians have to start showing their intolerance. And that can, that's going to be twofold, the culture dimension where we depict ourselves with a little bit of a mean streak. And secondly, more of these pastors and church leaders have to speak up and get the brunt of the force. And that, this is just something I believe like so much. Cause I mean, I've always been in the most degenerate cities, and I think I've been placed there for a reason. I do think so. And, you know, when I went to Ohio, I was like, that's beautiful, man. Go, get out of the cities and be fruitful and multiply. Love it. But I'm also, I'm sort of in this creative monk situation where I'm sort of like, you know, I would love that. And I romanticize about that, but I'm also realizing, you know, I'm kind of here to fight, and I have this fire in me where I just want to take on the Leviathan, you know?
Yeah. So, how do you, I just interviewed, Anthony Esalen actually yesterday. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but, people have, talked of him as being the Catholic version of Doug, you know, Wilson, and just very, he was at a college for 27 years and basically run out of town because of some stuff that he was doing by, you know, essentially in the college culture, the kids are the clients, you know, and so, or the customer, if you see, if you will. And so the university has become a place to try to siphon, you know, money into itself via debt, you know, and via these things. And I, in my personal things that we've kind of talked about at our church, it's literally where when your kid gets to be 18 and you haven't parented them, it's a small price to pay to it's continued daycare, if you will. Like, don't want to be, obviously it's a generalization. It's not every case, but it's in some ways, it's like you didn't raise your son to be able to go out and provide value to the world in 18 years that he was yours. And he's acting out because, like you said, he was put into this effeminate culture and told you need to act like a girl The girls are all sitting still. How come you can't sit still? You know? And so equality has her, and Esalen specifically speaks to wanting to do, the reason why he's fighting so hard is for boys that don't know better. When you're six and you're being made to feel like you're inadequate and you're being compared and you're being stereotyped in a sense because you've been put into a situation that God didn't wire you to do. Mm-hmm. And then college, you know.
I mean, there's two things I got to say to that. One is that I would say that if you want to study anything fluid in the texture of it, and I mean creative, you want to become a writer, you want to be a painter, you want to be a dancer. If it's fluid and it's organic and it's based on inspiration and your creative voice, you don't need to go to art school. You don't need to go to these schools. If you want to study a system, law, programming, engineering, it's a system. It's mechanical. That's a different story. And there's very little social justice in there anyways. And I believe that is a different story. So we need to first make that distinction. But secondly, I'll say absolutely. There's an old, in regards to boys being forced to sit still, there's this notion that, Aristotle once said that the two problems in society come from young people in the form of unchanneled, and unchanneled is in parentheses, and that means it was emphasized back then, unchanneled male aggression and female vanity. So he's absolutely right about that today, because that proliferates even to this day. And there are universalities that the ancients always repeat. And the further we forget away and stray away from these archetypal truths and the patterns, the Bible, the more we lose tie with the laws of the universe. And I believe that women are not more still. Their minds are more chaotic. That's all it is. So what happens is when boys are forced to sit like girls, their minds end up becoming even more rapid, and they end up playing into the same tricks or temperaments that the feminine psyche tends to uphold. And the very nature of masculinity and whatever it is that they do is to be grounded. So you can have them. We're way more tactile. We need to use our hands. We're way more physical, and we're in our mind. We're grounded when we're doing that, though, you know. And I think it's so crazy that these blue states, where all the institutional cultural pillars are that determine so much for the whole country, they just can't accept that men and women are different. It's just so crazy that we're still talking about this, but the door isn't even shut in that discussion, Nathan. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't even get the conversation on the table still. So we might just get to a point where this just expands to ideological civil war. Now, we already have hints of that, but it might get to the point where we have no choice, you know, because all the good people and all the God-fearing men and women will just go to the, you know, the more sovereign lands. And what's going to occur is that now people are literally separated by states by ideology, you know, and it's going to now become physical. That might get there. We don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that happening.
So talk about, maybe briefly, can you retell that moment that you talked about where they were approaching you to do this ideological gallery? Gallery.
So there's a gallery I was working with. They had eight artists at that moment. Just to get some clarity, I've had many of these interactions. I've had so many of these, but this is just the more fun story, I guess. So there's this pizza, this wood fire oven pizza place, Lower East Side. And the gallery, owner of the gallery, she invites her assistant, slash front desk girl, and all of their other artists, and then two other writers, big round table, you know. Ironically, there's 12 people. So we're all sitting down at this pizza table here.
The Lord has a sense of humor.
Or this woman is an absolute narcissist and is unconscious of her own nature.
Yeah.
So we're all sitting here. They order a bunch of pizzas. Good pizza, by the way. Good beer, too. So we're all just sitting down here, And I thought this was just another networking event. So I'm sitting here, there's a girl here, and there's another girl here, and then there's a woman here who's the owner and the director. So the girl next to me here is also an artist. I don't know this girl here. So, but we're all just talking, we're all connecting with one another and just chatting frivolously, whatever. We're having fun, right? And she says, so Arthur, I have a great idea. And this is something that I put a lot of thought into. You know, right now, Asians are being assaulted and targeted. You know, white supremacy is running rampant. We need to come together as artists and we need to speak up against it. So I was thinking, you show with my Black Lives Matter activist artist here, and we'll do a group show, both of you, a duo show, Black Lives Matter meets Stop Asian Hate. That's, and we're going to, you know, we'll invite a couple critics and we'll make a scene with it, right? And, you know, she's just trying to be trendy. And essentially, this is tokenism, right? And at this point, and we're fast forwarding quite a bit because in the timeline, there's many other things that occurred, many at the Norwood Club, it's like an art networking place. All of these things have occurred for me to basically have my cup of BS so full. So it's not even bravery. People have said, oh, Arthur, you're so brave. It's like, no. I was thrown into a very high tier in the art world where the saturation of wokeism and this desire to debase Western values is just so adamant that it's not even bravery. It really isn't. It's just like I'm getting nauseous. And you got to understand, you hang out with these people if you're working with them as dealers, like several times a week. Like, it's not like you see them once in a while. You have to spend time with them regularly. It's one of those things. So I looked at her then in the eyes, and this isn't a paraphrase. So I said this on stage also. I said, I think it's very odd that blacks assaulting Asians based on race is white supremacy. And it gets dead quiet on this side of the table, right? The other end doesn't hear, but this side gets like I can hear the DJ scratch. It's totally quiet.
Yeah.
And the girl next to me, she looks at me with like this disdain, and I see her like eyes like what was that? Whoa, who's this person at the table?
Yeah.
And she goes, like, and she says this like, I got you if I say this, like checkmate. She goes, well, what do you think about Black Lives Matter? Because the three sacred cows in New York City are Black Lives Matter, the feminist misandrist, and the LGBTQ rainbow people. Those are the three sacred cows you do not mention. And I just looked at her and then I said, well, I think Black Lives Matter is a modern blackface where white liberals like you use a black identity to push the radical left agenda.
Mm.
And it was dead silent. And I mean, look, there's no more connection after that. The burn has been bridged totally and it's been eviscerated. And then once it was eviscerated, I stood on top of it and took a piss on it. Like it's open and shut there, right? So I've had many of those instances, and you know, it at the time it felt very foolhardy because you know, Nathan, I've thought about this quite a bit. I've thought about this quite a bit. Why do good men not speak up? And I came to realize that moment right there is the answer. This explains why. It's one thing to, you know, speak your mind a little bit amongst your friends and then you offend a little bit. But if that HR lady hears about your views and you're looking at your children over there and you are providing their resources, and we're talking about the average man who just wants to stand up for what's right in his own family, but then he just wants to go and fight the world, bring back money and take care of his family. Average man, on average. If some liberal lady can castigate your income, you're an idiot if you speak up and jeopardize your children. So I understood right there. It's one thing to be hated. It's quite another to be hated and poor, especially if you have others that are, you are responsible for others. So I realized right there, because look, I've been this single creative monk for some time, right? But I understood even without having anyone to take care of, wow, they can snap me like Thanos. They can make you irrelevant because they own all these channels, especially if you're in the arts and entertainment. They don't want any Christianity in there. So we talk about the persecution of Christians, but, and you know, the martyrs are our heroes for a reason. And so we kind of understand that, you know, you will have, the world will be against you. Like, we kind of understand that to a degree, but man, when you see it happening to you directly, and when you see that they want nothing to do with you, and they expose their hypocrisy, you know, these same groups of people gave me Artist of the Year in 2020. And then the moment they discovered my Christian roots, they turned their back on me totally. Like, you realize that it's all about control and power. You start to kind of realize that there really is this culture fight ahead of us. And we don't have any traditional roads for us to follow and to put our artists to be venerated into. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. So in my own personal practice, I've realized that this is an opportunity, because a setback is a setup for a comeback, right? I've come to realize I am now the artist for those who want to stand up for what's right and stand up for masculinity, God, and the West. That is kind of my goal now. That is my goal, and I will use my art to do so and proliferate this imagery, and for us to understand that, you know, we need reverence. We need to appreciate the masculine in its proper place, not the toxic masculinity that they talk about, actual masculinity in its benevolence and honor. And I'm here in these states denying all the temptations and focusing on my artistry. Mm-hmm. It's been interesting, brother.
You asked kind of who out there are of you are artists at the conference.
So many hands went up.
A bunch of hands went up, but I felt like it was a percentage wise was 10-15%, you know. And I raised my hand. Maybe I didn't see exactly, because you saw from the stage, I was kind of off back left. I raised my hand and I kind of was like, I want to see every hand go up, I guess.
Oh, wow.
Because, and this is kind of one of the reasons why when I initially messaged you and was like, hey, Michael Foster came and said, what's your art? You know? And I'm like, I build, rooms.
Yeah.
You know, I create space with construction, and it needs to have a meta narrative that supports, and I specifically am in residential because I'm so passionate about the family. So I like coming into family spaces, the physical home, and transforming it. That's my company is transform this room or this house, the whole house, to be more efficiently do what it's supposed to do. And a lot of people don't know the theology behind why I do what I do. But, and then as I've thought about other ways that, you know, for me as an artist, so I was in the military, you know, Man on Fire, they talk about Creasy's art is death, you know, and he's about to paint his masterpiece, kind of Denzel Washington's character. That was my art in some ways, is this. And as you start to kind of categorize the fluid versus the system, I feel like warfare, construction, and some of these things maybe are viewed as rigid, and in some ways. But I wasn't until I read Austin Kleon's stuff. I'm sure you're probably familiar with him, but he was just saying, make good art and do it a lot. And so I kind of started to change my mindset from this, like, oh, this construction stuff, this is bread on the table, to like, no, I gotta get some books. I gotta study the principles. And as we design my wife and I design our house, like, there's reasons why molding is in rooms. Like it is, and there's all these different profiles, and there's things, and then also, if you're a parent, you've created children in a sense, and maybe arguably one of the only things that's truly original, in a sense. Or what are your thoughts on that?
I would totally agree with that. You said a lot of important things, but I'll add on to the last statement, which is you know, I started by sharing the book of Genesis and how there's implication in the story of creation that we are to be also be creators. And I think it's incredibly important for all men to recognize that they also have this line of romanticism, you know, because of course we should be traditionally masculine, which is stoic, competitive, aggressive, and dominant. Great. Mm-hmm. Those are important masculine qualities. But we should also understand that we actually have romantic reasons as to why we're walking towards our goals. We have something picturesque in our head. That is actually what we're walking towards. And that's totally romantic. And that's the first half of it. But I believe that we have to be creators. And this is a different, I never shared this on stage, but I've thought about this quite a bit. It's very important for men to be creators because it keeps them out of trouble when it comes to the toxicity of the modern sexual market today. Because if you raise a family and you're being a creator, what happens? You're with one woman and you are doing something honorable and you're creating a family and creating culture in that regard, right? If you are an artist, what happens when you practice sexual fornication and promiscuity? Well, it drains you of your creative spirit actually in the studio. So you kind of have to become more like celibate monk-like. So men have to be creative one way or another to sort of avoid the physical temptations of the body. You know, it's okay to have those thoughts because that's what we have as men, but acting upon them is quite a different thing, right? But if you have a creative discipline, you are able to sort of preserve your sensibility when it comes to what creation is meant for. And the whole creative act, the whole creative spirit, whether it's with art or whether it's biologically speaking, it's supposed to be in service to the Most High in one way or another, right? Mm-hmm. Something, a goal above you. It should be pointing upwards, you know, and all good art points upward as well, which is why I was showing some art earlier, you know, in the presentation in Ohio. I was showing art that was all about pointing towards the light. And that's what you do to your kids. You know, you're being an example and you're telling them stories and missions and values to point in that direction too. So I just believe that men must become creators of some sort, you know, because it actually keeps them out of trouble. Yeah.
For sure. Well, in channeling that energy and creative spirit, you mentioned that you attained a skill set by, mm-hmm. you know, you went to a school, you got a skill set. And
I didn't learn any of that in art school, by the way. I learned that on my own. Art school taught me about the stupid Klingon language, intersectionality, all these terms that paint the world as this demonic place because of my male spirit and because of white guys like you, Nathan. All these shenanigans. I did develop the skill set. Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, I guess I would say, you know, speak to that as a perfect kind of setup to where I'm going with this in a sense. Like, so you have this Klingon language that you said, you have this skill set that you learned on your own. You know, talk about why it's important. Because I would argue if you didn't do the work and in some ways, maybe that understanding that language. You know, I just heard Doug speak at Grace Agenda in Moscow about the reason why pastors have such an issue is they're not bilingual. They don't understand the way the world speaks. Or if they are, they forgot what the primary language is, and that's the language of the Bible. So you don't assume the second, you know, in some of the ways where language is preserving culture and is preserving these things. And so I guess in my mind, I guess where I'm going with that is how this mastering the skill set, speaking the language, and why is it, how is that helpful for you? And why is it important that men do the work like that or put in the effort?
So I've had many, especially younger artists, approach me, and they basically asked me, you know, I want to depict this. I've had this recurring dream, or I've read this novel. I want to depict this imagery. And I'm telling you all this is because when it comes to creating something, you know, that's actually well done and respected, you need to learn the rules to break the rules. Mm-hmm. So what that means is discipline. Absolutely. And the first thing one must do to actually develop and ascertain a skill set is to understand the distinction of pleasures. In other words, there's physical pleasures, hedonistic pleasures, good food, sexual intercourse, getting a massage, whatever it is. There's physical base primal pleasures. And then there's higher pleasures. And the highest pleasure in that regard is the mastery and discipline of a skill, which implies sacrifice at that. And if you don't have that understanding in the first place, you're never going to actually get that good at something, especially something as difficult to grasp as a creative field. So that's the first thing. So I would approach from that vantage point is you need to love and honor the difficulty and the process associated with it. And then that's sort of how you're going to get your artistic voice. What was your second question to that?
Well, I guess you kind of answered it, or at least left it where the intellectually honest could make the jump, you know, why it's important. Because I think that it was, you say, I want to slay the Leviathan, you know?
You need the tools to do so. I like to look at a lot of these culture wars from a bird's eye view, and then how we can actually do the labor, the actual action behind it after we look at this. And as far as I can see, for several generations now, the right has defined its investment as simply an ROI. In other words, the digits in a bank account, how that returns. And I think that was a bad strategy, because while we should be capitalists and we have the right to do so, and I'm not harping on capitalism at all because I'm here selling art. My point is, when a person has the means to also invest into the arts, what occurs is that basically we left all of the creative pillars and institutions empty for the left to fill that vacuum. And now we're in a place where they control all the dreamscapes and entertainment that is constantly brainwashing our progeny and onwards. And they have all the content, and they do all the numbers, and they get all the mass exposure, because they get to determine those who are in line with their values, get exposure toward with their channels that they've built. And I believe we need to also look at investment as having your hands on the actual wheel of culture, which is by either creating art or patronizing those who have the right values, who are trying to spread the good news with their art one way or another, because that is one form of evangelizing in ministry. And I don't think that gets enough credit, because there are so many faith-based artists. Remember when they raised their hands, maybe it was 10-50%, but believe it or not, that's pretty good. for our kin, because usually when I go to these right-leaning circles, I'm like, okay, I'm with you all here, beautiful, freedom of speech, right, the wrongs in the family, we're all on the same page here. But it's usually less, to be honest. That's how bad it is, Nathan.
I think that that's indicative of what Michael Foster's cultivating where he is. That the percentage is higher, and you know, it's like I said, it's based on you know, if you would have asked me that 5 or 6 years ago, I probably wouldn't have raised my hand. Like I said, I was in that, and for me, I used to draw when I was younger, and I remember having a gal that was in college for art or whatever, older girl. I was at a swim meet, and I was coloring, or I was sketching a you know, flagpole and the American flag or whatever. And she's like, yeah, she's like, you should come up. You should really think about art. You know, you should think about going to art school or whatever, you know? And I told that to my mom or whatever. I'm like, you know, cause I think it was, you know, 14, 15, whatever. And my mom was like, yeah, you can't make any money at that, you know? And I not disparaging my mother, but I feel like when you talk about the bottom line, that is, you know, entrepreneur household. My dad's an engineer. He learned a system. You know, my creative side was fueled by my grandmother, who took me to plays, took me to these things. And
that's amazing.
And even the pieces are there for me to make the connection when it's important. Cause that's why one of the things I feel like, looking back at my story, and I'm sure you can do the same, is if you take time to reflect and see, you can see the pieces fit.
Well, your grandmother is awesome for that, because most people who lean in our direction, they just emptily repeat the mantra that politics is downstream from culture. And they're not actual active participants, or they're not actually feeding that flame. And of course, like, it is incredibly difficult to monetize your creativity, and most people will not be in a position to, you know, actually, most people, they can't sustain themselves that way. But it's important to have either a creative outlet, or to support those who are willing to take the heat. It is important, because, I'm speaking as an insider who's been venerated by the radical left, who basically is a party of sin. I've seen it happen to the extent that, you know, you can have every statistic and data point clear and concise on your end, and you could have done all the surveying, but none of it's going to matter if the person you're talking to has big tech, you know, academia, art gallery, Hollywood, and entertainment. Because they'll just influence the masses while you're talking about, yeah, but it's this percentage, and I've done the spreadsheeting, and I have the data. Great, good. But that only works on reasonable people. And most people are not reasonable. Most people are lost, and it doesn't matter, actually. And it's hard for conservatives to hear that, because we are reasonable. So when we talk about the numbers, it makes sense. But you have to understand, most people, including people who have our values, especially those who are closer to, you know, cities, when you're off work in your relaxed state, what are you taking in? What are you consuming? What are you feeding your soul? Food for the soul, right? What are you feeding your soul? You're feeding the junk food that they've created, right? And I'm just saying that we, as honorable men, we need to start feeding them some, aesthetically as a metaphor, steaks. Like, we need to start putting in something with a little bit more oomph. So that's amazing that your grandmother did that for you, but men have actually been discouraged to care about the arts. You know, we mentioned Tanner earlier. And I love the phrase that he proliferates on his social media, that but real men don't care about how they look, that idea. And that's awesome, because I mean he's doing it, you know what I'm talking about, right? When he does that as a
play
joke.
On it.
Yeah, he does that as a play. Well, there's something very deep he's implying, which is, in the same way that men cannot actually escape their religious nature, men cannot escape their aesthetic nature. It's just whether they're conscious of it or not. That's all it really is. And when people are not conscious of it, they're actually unconsciously possessed by it, which is why every time a man tells me, oh, you know, men shouldn't care about art or fashion or all of this, every single time a man has pointed this out and tried to make me seem like a sissy or whatever it is, they always look like bodybuilders. They're always muscle bound. They always look so driven in this aesthetic pursuit. And I can't help but always tell them, you care about aesthetics to the point that you're at the gym 3-4 days a week for several hours. You care about aesthetics so much. You're possessed by an aesthetic ideal. But the difference is, you're demonizing other people because they are trying to achieve aesthetics with a different type of substance. And it's important to understand that these psychological phenomena that exist in our psyche, they are inseparable. You cannot escape them, which is why, like, in the religious component as well, it's not a coincidence that it's over 70% of atheists that vote for the proliferation of the state. That's not a coincidence. because they're putting that religious vehemence onto their faith into the government rather than in higher order. So people always have these impulses. It's just important to understand because the modern postmodern milieu, actually, postmodernism believes that human beings are under the guise of social deconstructionism. In other words, we can move things willy-nilly. Men can be women, children can be chemically castrated, whatsoever, whatever definition they want to interchangeably move, right? Mm-hmm. Because they believe you can actually negate these qualities. You can just delete your aesthetic appreciation or your picturesque goal. You can just get rid of your notion towards hierarchical spiritual truth or order itself, which is implied by when you get rid of that. And it's all propounding relativism, essentially. And that's what I'm seeing in front of me here every time I walk into a gallery. I don't even go into galleries now, but when I was in that scene, that's all I've seen all over the map. And it's just time we sort of step up in every cultural domain. And you know, it's this is why your podcast is important, and this is why what I'm trying to do with my paintings are important as well. It's just men saying, "Hey, we're gonna take it back," because it's not a new weird thing about, oh, men shouldn't care about art and all these things. No, we were the primary spokesman for all these subjects. We're trying to take it back from them. That's the spirit that I'm speaking from.
So help me out a little bit here too. When we go into, so we go to the art gallery, there's one in Raleigh, and take our kids, and they've had a Rembrandt exhibition and things. So there's been some good stuff, but I'll say, you know, in some of the stuff you said, is it Duchamp's work?
Marcel Duchamp. Urinal.
Yeah. And you showed the banana taped to the wall and things.
The comedian, yes.
When a guy like me sees that, and I'm not a student in any way of that, or I am, because I'm a living being that's trying to always enhance my appreciation for the aesthetics, and I understand where that comes from. When I look at those things, and I'm like, I could do that, or that doesn't show skill, or that's stupid. And then the response is like, well, you don't understand what this is actually like. They're like kind of saying, you're actually the dumb one.
It's pretentious.
Yeah. And it's the same thing, like the emperor's not wearing clothes, you know, kind of thing. And you say it, you're the kid that's like, the emperor's naked, you know, and then everybody in just talk me through that and why.
Well, Nathan, there's a lot to say about that. First of all, the actual galleries are meant to be for the people. Galleries are first. I mean, they're so this pretentiousness and elitism, this is all. I mean, this is a more recent thing as well. And it's a shame because, art is for anyone. You know, what is this idea that art is only for, the bourgeoisie? You know, that's an absolute illusion. But they have to kind of have that social construct. In other words, BS, because the art is so weak today. So whenever you look at art, you have to ask yourself two questions. When you look at fine art, two questions. One, does this take actual skill? Number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, if it does take skill, is there cultural value in it? So what I just described is formalism, which is actual technique, layering, rendering abilities, compositional awareness, color theory, the actual skill set, technically speaking. The second thing is contextualism. What are they denoting symbolically or philosophically? What are they standing for? What is this, what kind of statement is this art making? Good art will do both. If it's just beautifully done, you know, it's a beautiful landscape, it's nice, but there's nothing riveting. And if it's just, if it's just something symbolic, but then it's not technically done at a heightened level, you're not going to look at it for too long, right? So what I'm seeing is we're lacking both today. That's why I don't work with the gallery model as a person who was getting multiple solo exhibitions regularly. The reason why I got Artist of the Year so fast was because I was just being like an old school painter in that regard. In this world that's basically lost and severed all its ties with wisdom. So whenever you go to look at any art, just I'll first of all say galleries are pretty much a waste of time unless you meet you see the anomaly. And but you should ask yourself those two questions. Does this take skill? And secondly, what is a cultural value? And that and if somebody makes you feel like an outsider or you don't belong in all this, it's because they're pretentious losers who are lost in this echo chamber. That is why. Because at the end of the day, you look at any other artistic expression, Nathan, any other artistic expression. Let's say you go to watch a ballet show and then everybody's doing this perfect dance form and they're denoting the gesture that you know traditionally in ballet that is takes years of practice and skill to do at a heightened level. And in a ballerina that then jumps on the stage and falls flat on her face. And then she expects you to regard her as bold and daring. And she demands a round of applause and a standing ovation. That's the equivalent to the banana duct tape to a wall. Mm-hmm. Any other art form, any other creative art form has been this way, right? They will never pull this off. But I think because the fine arts sphere is in cabal with the government schools, and the higher education where it's essentially channels of cultural Marxism. I think those two being in conjunction with the fact that the art industry can also be used as a financial instrument to money launder for nefarious purposes. I think those three is a very nice dark triangle for the radical left to use it as a social club. And that's what's happened quite a bit, you know, and I'm not going to name any specific people, but I've gotten to go out with sushi with people who I've heard stories where they're doing certain things. And I couldn't help but think like, yep, this is I'm in the belly of the beast, man. And I now want to pivot that and find ways to shake up the field as much as I can. But and I can produce great art, but you know, now the next stage now is while I was getting patronage from in my social camouflage, now I need to now get patronage from those who have analogous values. That's the next step for me. Yeah.
Yeah. So talk about that for those listening. If they're sitting in the seat of, probably should go to and figure out how to channel that aesthetic aspect, that creative aspect of who they are, whether it's as a hobby or whatever. But if they're finding themselves pretty firmly in the patronage side, how can they, you know, how can they help? How can the average ordinary guy, man make art galleries for him now, you know, or in institute things? And what's the process? How do you see that working? If you could tell.
Well, Nathan, first I'll say there is no art gallery for guys like us right now. Mm-hmm. There isn't. Time will tell if the project that I'm working on with a couple of my peers, if we can open this faith-based gallery, which would be totally a unique cultural uppercut. So there's that is in conversation. Now it's going to be some time because there's a lot of planning to do this sort of endeavor. So that's one wrinkle of it. But I'll just say, if you want to support and feed the flame of creating more art that is in line with your values and putting it in the public square, you can go to arthurquilling.com/support. If you are interested in art itself and putting beauty in your home, to actually acquire paintings and a commission, you go to my contact form and just reach out to me. I have works, small works that are more affordable to large works, but they're the value and investment of putting art in your home, it is insurmountable. The energy permeates through your whole home, right? Mm. And I think when people experience that, they realize, wow, we need to participate in the culture. And the reason why so much decadence is being normalized is simply because we're not in the creative space. Mm. So that psychological click needs to first realize But yeah, that's where you can support. You can also find me on heavily shadow banned. But if you go on Instagram and you type my full name, Arthur Kwon Lee, then I should show up. And if you are an artist and you want to be connected with other creatives who also are mission oriented in that regard, I don't mean just Christian mission oriented, in regards to the fact that they're using their art with the recognition of the dark culture we're in, the shadow that we're living under. And we sort of like a rebel alliance. I have an art collective called the Genesis Council. And we have filmmakers, photographers, sculptors, painters, poets, writers, whatever. And we support each other. We share each other's work. We critique each other. And if we have networking opportunities associated with our field that we run into, we try to help each other out. So those are sort of the plugs that I can throw out. I am working on a project that I will be mentioning in about a month also. And it's very mission oriented as well. But it's not ready to unveil yet. So I'll leave that. So those are sort of my shout outs in conjunction to how you can support this weird self-hating Asian, apparently.
Mm. help you find your way.
Yes, brother.
Absolutely. Well, I really appreciate your time. I know that,
likewise, first and
foremost, I wanted to, you know, have this conversation with you. I think that I realized a similar time in my life would be when I was in the military and the only Christian, you know, and traveling.
Really? And, in the military?
Well, in the tight circles, you know, of where you're like a platoon of 40 Rangers, you know, out. And then there's times where other Christians would be one more or two more, you know, but not necessarily in the same tent, you know, because there's squads in different tents or there'd be social camouflage for some of the guys or whatever. I elected to not have social camouflage kind of right off the bat. And it can be, first of all, I feel like that's where the Lord sustains you as well. Like you get to experience, you talk about that energy in your home or whatever. If you haven't been in the fight, in a physical, spiritual way, you don't know what we're talking about, but the Lord pouring out and even speaking to my kids about this is like God's given you, the Holy Spirit lives inside of you and he's given you the ability to get, my daughter talking to her about contentment, you know, he's given you the ability right now to rule over this and to make your way out of this and you got this, you know. And
So, I mean, I can say as a man, if you know, I shared this as a man, if the devil is leaving you alone, you're either doing wrong or you're not public enough about your values.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's a great, great admonition to leave with our listeners, you know, if you're being apathetic, if you're in camouflage, but also, you know, seek the timing, seek the wisdom from the Lord, like what you did too. I think you called your dad, what do I do?
Oh yeah. And he's he's a OG. So he's also was like, I didn't add this in the speech, but he was like, also all these hate mail that you're getting, this, you don't have to look at your phone.
Yeah.
Like you could actually just go out for a walk or you go for a hike and then like, if you know, you can't control what happens to you, but you can control how you react 100%. So I was like, okay. And then he just basically told me like, hey, look, he's a public minister who's said things about, you know, Virginia here. They tried to do this push for like LGBTQ services and all this with their church groups and all this. And he's publicly stated that, you know, we're not going to entertain anything of the sort. And when it was written about in this like local newspaper disparagingly, like he literally looked at it like it was a honk while he was driving. That's it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm like, there's also this attitude frame. There's something about old school alpha male though too. It's like the old version too, where it's like, it's just white noise kind of thing. You just keep walking on. So I was like, It might be indicative. Hint of wisdom there.
Indicative to maybe social media not being part of his formation, and
100%
disconnected, yeah. And realizing really because the majority of his life was in the real, is being grounded. There was nothing to pull him out of that artificially. There's no
base reality.
He's based. He's good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Amen, brother. Right. Well, listen. Yep. Well, listen. Love to your family, man, and love to you, brother, and you know, just keep on offending everyone and continuing on in your stride, brother.
Yep, sounds great. Blessings to you, brother.
Blessings, brother.
There you have it, y'all. As promised in the intro, I would like to direct you to Arthur's website. It is Arthur Kwon Lee, ArthurKwonLee.com. And when you go to that website, you're going to see Blood and Fire, which is the gallery that he just released. Mission-oriented art series devoted to spreading the aesthetic appreciation of masculinity. Who can't get behind that? As soon as I saw that hit social media, I went and bought my own version of original artwork by this guy, because I know the Lord is going to prosper him first and foremost, and I want to get behind him. I want to be one of the guys that can say that I tangibly used some money and got behind what he's doing. And guess what, guys? Randomly selected artwork that this guy did, guess which one I got? Sitting right behind me on a bookshelf. It will be in the background of almost every single Life on Target podcast that I do from this point forward. I got Hercules. So excited. Because one of the things that he wants you to do is when you get this randomly selected piece of art, original artwork from him, it gives you an opportunity to take time and study more about that particular figure and spread art, and also have a symbol in your home of something that is masculine, not toxic, and reminds us that men built the world. Stay tuned next week, y'all, because I got Anthony Eslin. I'm going to continue on this theme of men building the world. As always, have a good one.